Hi, everyone. I'm Raj Kumar, President and Editor-in-Chief of DevEx. This week, we'll be breaking down the big headlines in global development and bringing in some top experts to help us do it. If you want to follow along with the stories we're talking about, check out devx.com and subscribe to our daily newsletter, The Newswire. There's a link in the description. Follow us along on Twitter, and you can see many of the stories we're talking about today. And we'd love to hear what you think. This is This Week in Global Development.
Hi, I'm Kate Warren, Executive Vice President and Executive Editor at DevEx. You're listening to DevEx at South by Southwest, our special edition of This Week in Global Development. The annual South by Southwest Conference in Austin, Texas, is known for its eclectic mix of innovators and policymakers. It's a unique place where film stars and artists co-mingle with tech entrepreneurs and social change makers to discover new ideas and spark inspiration. Increasingly, it's also become a hotspot for global development leaders looking to break out of the usual event circuit echo chamber. I'm here at South By to talk with leaders about ways that technology and innovation can supercharge the Sustainable Development Goals. Listen in for what's next in a range of sectors, from food to health to climate and conflict, and how these advancements can reach the most vulnerable. In this episode, we'll hear from Anne-Marie Burgoyne, Managing Director of Emerson Collective. Emerson Collective is a limited liability company, or LLC, founded by philanthropist Lorene Powell Jobs. Emerson Collective uses a range of tools from philanthropy to impact investing to policy advocacy to make progress on issues like education, the environment, immigration, and health equity. I spoke with Anne-Marie following a conversation here at South By on mobilizing philanthropy to combat climate change, which also featured Catherine Coleman Flowers from the Center for Rural Enterprise and Environmental Justice. We discuss Emerson Collective's unique approach, its growing work on climate through the Waverly Street Foundation, and how Emerson Collective looks at the role of artificial intelligence and social change. Here is our conversation. Well, Anne-Marie, thank you so much for joining me here. I want to hear a little bit more about Emerson Collective's approach to philanthropy. I know you have kind of a unique model, and so maybe for our audience that's a little less familiar with how you operate, you can just give us an overview.
I'm glad to do that. And our philanthropy, probably first and foremost, doesn't come through a foundation structure. We are structured as an LLC, and our philanthropy team is a team within a multi-toolbox social change organization. So we do our work through donor-advised funds, which allows us a lot of flexibility on where we give dollars. So that's one observation. Another is our philanthropic team sits beside a number of social change tools. So there's a venture team, a team that's really strong at building brand, a comms team. We have a pretty robust fellowship program, an advocacy team, a fairly large convening team. And so the conversation we have is, how is philanthropy one aspect of moving forward social change in conversation with lots of other tools that can be used? So that's another piece of our work. Another aspect is we've made a really conscious decision to do almost all of our grants as general operating multi-year grants. And so the consequence of that is that we get to know the organization, the leader, the team. And then as we get to know them, our belief is wherever we put our dollars, the decision rests with the leader and the team on where the highest, best use of those dollars is at any given time. So it allows there to be more trust and conversation in the model. We've also chosen to be very, very deep in diligence and then to be much less controlling during the life of a grant. So our reporting is fairly light touch. And our desire during the couple, 3 years of a grant partnership is to find ways to be of use. To that end, we have an annual call with other people from Emerson Collective to offer connectivity. We have a fairly large menu of capacity building supports that folks can use, and each year they renew everything on the list. We have a number of teams at Emerson that are actually quite helpful often to grantee partners, our tech team, our brand team, our comms team. And so we use the opportunity to be in conversation throughout the years to find ways to create those partnerships. So we've tried to really think about the philanthropy as being about finding strong leaders and teams that are finding solutions and then trying to bring other resources to those solutions beyond just the dollars, but recognizing that flexible dollars is a really helpful way to provide them.
Yeah, so there has been a lot of talk and interest in, you know, trust-based philanthropy, or however you might want to phrase that. You know, how come you chose this model, and what would be some of the advantages of it that, you know, maybe other philanthropies or those considering how to, you know, better fund initiatives, why this is a better approach than maybe some of the traditional send out a RFA, apply for a grant, keep your overheads low, one year project, and then it's done?
Yeah, no, it's a fair question. I mean, one observation I'd make is Lorraine and I were both nonprofit leaders, and so I think we're coming to philanthropy with a mindset of how challenging it was to do the kind of philanthropy you just described, or to take on that kind of philanthropy. And so for us, on one level, we were asking the question, what would it mean if a philanthropist showed up as a partner? Recognizing there is still an exchange of dollars, that it's important given that there are so many opportunities for where those dollars could be deployed to do it thoughtfully, but then what else could be part of that relationship? I'll also observe I came out of the Drape Richards Kaplan Foundation, and we had a fairly trust-based model. It had a funny truncation point in that we did grants for a certain amount of time and there were no renewals. So that in some ways had this really interesting dynamic where once the grant was made, you really were in a conversation for a number of years because there was nothing at the end of that rainbow. So you really had to be in conversation during. And so we were trying to capture the spirit of that in the way we do the work now. Because we're structured the way we are too, I think we had a realization that at some point we wanted to be able to help an organization to focus on the work, and we thought we had a role to play, or a possible role to play in that too. And so if you didn't find a place to build trust and then have deep, important conversation, you couldn't make those matches. You couldn't understand where offering might make sense. And I'll also say in our offering, that menu, the curated opportunities, we're very much about optionality. So just because we come and say, would this be interesting, you're absolutely welcome to say the answer is no. And that's been part of the trust-based piece too, is you don't want people showing up at convenings or taking on opportunities simply because they think that's an expectation. So in some ways, I think it was a very planful choice. And in some ways, in an effort to be a team that is learning and acknowledging that the landscape has changed a whole lot, you almost find if you don't come to a trust-based model, you're spending a lot of time on the wrong things, reading reports, setting expectations that might not be delivered, and then the possible right things you never have enough time to nurture.
So what kind of frameworks or methodologies do you use to measure the impact or success?
I think that's a really good question. It's different in different parts of the philanthropic work because there's different pieces of our portfolio that are differently evolved. So our education portfolio has been with us for quite a long time. And so there really are aspects of work you can look at to see the journey of a set of students through an educational experience. And some of the pieces you'll look at are numbers, and directionally you have a sense, given where the field sits, of what ideally those numbers should be. There's other pieces, I think, that are less numeric but highly tangible. When you listen to a young person describe the learning they've had, the agency they've felt, the opportunities they see in front of them, the optimism they feel, I recognize that's a different kind of measurement, but it's pretty powerful. There's parts of the portfolio, the immigration portfolio, where there's aspects where the piece that we've been seeking, which is around immigration reform, has been quite challenging. And so the pieces along the way, and I think one of the things that we're learning to appreciate more in that sector is celebrating smaller victories and opportunities. But I feel like when organizations find those and celebrate them, it's quite powerful. We've had some interesting technology plays that have been building up, which I feel like at least allow, when there's data sets and there's ways to support people by giving them more rich information sets, we're able to do that. And then there's places, honestly, where part of the success has been an organization identifying what success is for them and understanding how that fits into the ecosystem. So if I look at an organization like Hope Credit Union, their goal over time has been to serve in more regions, more people, but they've also wanted to serve more young people, and they've had success with that. They're starting to build a stronger back-end technology, which both makes all of their work more secure. It allows it to be accessible to more people. It allows them to use the knowledge they have to serve more people in different and more robust ways. And so in allowing the partners to define success, you understand the model better and differently. And then when they have that success, you very much see the power and possibility of it.
Are you looking for the inside story on what's happening at organizations like the World Bank, USAID, or the Gates Foundation? Then you need to be reading DevEx Pro. I'm Jessica Abrahams, and I'm the editor of DevEx Pro. Pro is DevEx's premium news subscription, where our expert reporters and analysts take you beyond the headlines, deep into the trends and institutions shaping the $200 billion aid industry. As well as all our news, you'll get access to conversations with global development leaders, resources to help you grow in your career, and a subscriber-only newsletter full of insider news and tidbits. See for yourself by getting a free trial today at devx.com/pro.
So the panel you were just on focused on philanthropy being able to play a role in climate action, and climate is impacting everything these days. How do you think about climate and prioritizing that or evolving the kinds of programs and partners you choose, and how much is that a part of your portfolio?
It's interesting. Climate has been a really evolving aspect for us. So I would make the observation for more than a decade, we've had a piece of the portfolio that's focused on environment, environmental justice, food access. There's been aspects of that bigger body of work that we've been exploring and understanding. And at this juncture point, that work is more squarely focused on environmental justice. And if you were to have looked at that portfolio a couple, 3 years ago, the goals of that portfolio were focused on having more organizations, building a bigger group of people who understood environmental justice and wanted to engage in it and had skills to engage. And then there was a piece around taking existing policy and pushing to assure that it was more likely to be honored and used. What's interesting, though, is as that landscape has shifted, and there's actually quite a few federal dollars at play, we've both been seeking out and encouraging organizations in the portfolio to move toward helping communities to access those dollars more readily, and then when those dollars come in, to use them to build infrastructure, which both supports the communities in their own development and also is greatly helpful in terms of climate. So that's the environmental justice part of the work. I'll also observe Emerson Collective has a foundation that focuses on climate. So unlike Emerson Collective, that does not have a foundation structure, the Waverly Street Foundation is a foundation. And that work is now focused on the overlap of climate and community. It's very much about finding projects that both help a community to increase its own infrastructure and possibility to leave with a greater number of livelihoods and ways that the community over time can have more value for the people that live there. The two topic areas that that are going to be the climate focus there are renewable energy and regenerative agriculture, and they've been honing in on states in the Southwest and a handful of countries across the globe for that work. So that's another place I'd say climate resides. We also have Elemental Accelerator, which has been a partner for a long time. They're both kind of within Emerson Collective, but they're also a grantee partner. And EEX has a portfolio, they are a nonprofit, but they have a portfolio of for-profit companies that are all in various regenerative spaces, transportation, food access, building of different sorts, water. And that's been kind of fun because it brings a different lens to the work. It allows you to see how nonprofit dollars can actually live in community in a way that can be funded and financed differently. I'd also observe that on our venture team, we have a team that focuses on energy and green tech. And what's been great about that is there ends up being lots of diligence and knowledge that's shared across that group. And then the final thing I'd observe, and I think this shows that climate lives in many, many places at Emerson Collective, is a couple years ago, we ran what we called the Climate Special Grant Round. And we do special grant rounds every couple years. They're only for organizations in the portfolio. And it's an RFP, but it's an internal RFP. And the prompt was, without feeling like you're having mission drift, is there work you're taking on or could consider taking on that would acknowledge that climate change seems like it's going to profoundly matter to all of us everywhere? And we had probably 100 folks apply. We selected 20. We've now brought that cohort together twice. And it's quite powerful because we have a number of folks in the US, but folks also came from Canada, Bangladesh, Rwanda, Belgium, like from all over the world. But Teach for All is creating a global open source platform of curriculum for teachers to use to teach climate. MEDIC, which is an organization which builds the backbone for community health workers, is creating aspects of that backbone that allow people who watch health, public health in communities to understand how climate, as the climate is changing and being especially punishing to people, how that changes disease burden. And so if you're a community health worker where you're looking to provide preventative or proactive support, Array, which is Ava DuVernay's, one of the organizations within her set of organizations, the film Origin was an entirely green film, but it was done in a way that was much more aggressive and thoughtful than maybe what industry standard has been to date. And now there's a playbook for that. And all of those were part of this Climate Special Grant Round. So it's been very exciting to watch how education is climate, culture is climate. What was really powerful when this group came together a few weeks ago was people said, I'm so excited we came to this work a couple years ago, that you encouraged us to start a conversation. One organization, TUMO, and they're in Armenia, and they created these stations, and they came in sort of a container, and it was kind of like a weather station, but much more cutting edge. And the students across Armenia, there's 60 or 70 of them now, built these systems as a way to understand climate change in their communities. But what happened was, as the team at TUMO watched the students build these projects, they recognized that everything about their organization should change in terms of how they interacted with the built and non-built environment. And it changed how they did sourcing, it changed how they thought about configurations of people and staff and when they gathered. And it was really interesting to listen to this group of scientists talk about how this project that was climate-based for the students they focused on then reflected back and changed the way they thought about climate within their organization. So in some ways, climate is everywhere, truly, but we've really tried to take that on and acknowledge that at Emerson Collective too.
Can you talk a little bit about your international work? So you do a lot of work here domestically in the US, but also internationally. I struck with the panel you had earlier with Catherine and mentioning some of the wastewater challenges they have in rural Alabama, being similar to challenges you might find in Haiti or elsewhere. So maybe talk a little bit about your work you're doing internationally and then how you see those interacting. I think often in the global development space, there's a silo between what's happening in the global south and what's happening in, say, North America, where often challenges of inequity and low resource environments are similar. So how do you think about that broader portfolio between your domestic and international work?
It's interesting you say that, and I intimated this a little bit, but a number of the organizations that were part of our Climate Special Grant Round were organizations that work in non-US settings. If I were to observe, several of the organizations that were part of that portfolio are focused on some flavor of regenerative agriculture, and often in places where, if there aren't new agricultural solutions found, people will have to leave those places. I mean, there's just going to be a fundamental need for climate migration because the place where people are cannot serve them. Some of those places are often also have challenges with conflict, but not always. Sometimes it's simply the climate. One of the organizations was an organization in Haiti, and they're doing some really beautiful reforestation work. Which both had a livelihood component and then had this reforestation piece, but I would also observe had a real hope component, that it allowed the community to see that there was something that could be invested in, which both was joyful and could support young people, the next generation of young people. One of the organizations is an organization in Rwanda, which is historically focused on building more healthy buildings, finding ways to seal dirt floors, for example, so that they were more environmentally friendly, but they were also healthier. And now they've been bringing those questions to entire built environment questions. That was really exciting. Ashesi University, which is in Ghana, their entire school has really, and what's exciting is when you're a university and you're only a couple decades old, you can really say, we can do a do-over, and the footprint is of a size where you can have a do-over. But every student at that school, by the time they graduate, I would argue, will understand that they are a climate end person. They're an engineer and a climate person. They're a technologist and a climate person. And that's been exciting to learn about that. And so your question was really a synthesis question. I will observe that I think many of our grantee partners, probably mostly all of them, have been very thoughtful about climate. And maybe it's because it feels so immediate to them. Maybe it's because some of their funders have actually flipped to climate and they've recognized that to remain relevant or to continue to find opportunities, they need to kind of take that in and think about it. But there's been some very exciting opportunities. And one of the things that was very true when we had this day of, or two of conversation was the number of people in U.S. settings who said, oh, there's so much I can learn here, which is something we always believe is so powerful. So I feel like there really is a lot of presence there of that.
And so when you're thinking about future priorities, I feel like we're at South By, have to talk about tech innovation, AI. How are you thinking about a lot of these advancements as being critical to the projects and organizations you choose to support?
It's a great question. I will make an observation, which is both, we have been seeking out organizations that have AI at the center, but much more focused on organizations that are having conversations about, I'm going to call it just allocation or distribution of opportunity, which is a less noisy playing field. A set of voices it's a little harder to break through on, but we also feel like important voices. I'll also make the observation that as we've worked with folks in the portfolio, there's much less use of AI than we hoped or thought there would be. And I don't say that as anything but an observation. And I think one of the reasons is it's actually quite hard to bring tech talent into the nonprofit sector. A lot of it has to do with pay. Some of it has to just do with recognition of opportunities. And then, of course, you can't have, you know, it's like a one-hand clapping problem. You can't have one technologist in an organization and solve for something. They need to have a team. And then at some level, you need to level up everybody in the organization of some knowledge. It's actually time-consuming and costly. And then, of course, the technology is evolving so quickly. So on the one hand, we're certainly seeking out folks who are in that conversation and trying to bring some important aspects to the conversation. I'd also observe that there are some organizations in the portfolio who are finding really interesting ways to use AI, and whether that's in terms of they've historically done very intensive data-based work as a way to understand where to serve or how to serve better, and they're trying to figure out how to do that using large language models, for example. There's other folks that if they distribute or they use any sort of almost like an operations model to allocate resources, they're trying to figure out how to use data differently there. But we're realizing it's a journey. And so if I go back to the observation about how we've used capacity building, we now have OpenAI office hours for folks in the portfolio to talk to members of our technology team to begin to figure out where they are in a journey. We last year had a number of organizations that came together for a day with an AI company to learn about possibilities. And we're continuing to work with that group. And at the same time, we have another cohort that's going to come through and do something similar. We learned some things last year, so we want to be stronger at that. I'll also say Rafi Krikorian, our CTO, has a podcast called Technically Optimistic, which the first season was quite good, and the second season's coming out soon. And I have often been told by folks in the portfolio that they've learned a lot from that content. So I put that out there as a learning tool for everyone. And so I guess what I would say is we're looking for those possibilities, and we've also had to acknowledge that the sector we work with is not at a place always to take advantage of them as rapidly.
Well, thank you so much, Anne-Marie, for taking the time today. It was lovely speaking with you, and we look forward to following more of your work. Thanks for listening to DevEx at South by Southwest, a special edition of This Week in Global Development. If you enjoyed today's episode, please share it, or you can also leave us a rating or a review. Make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform. If you want to share feedback on this episode or have any questions you'd like answered, we'd love to hear from you. Drop me a message on social media at Kate D. Warren or send an email to podcast@devx.com. DevEx at South by Southwest is a podcast from DevEx. It's hosted by me, Kate Warren. Today's episode was produced by Catherine Cheney and edited by Naomi Mihara.